Welcome to State of Affairs. I'm Julie Credens. Hundreds, perhaps thousands of books have been written about marriage, about what makes them work, what makes them fail, how to strengthen them, how to know when it's time to leave. And it seems more often than not, marriage is viewed from a female perspective, with titles that pose questions like, how to know if he really loves you, why men cheat, what wives should know about their husbands. When journalist Neil Chethick recognized this dearth of male viewpoint books on marriage, he decided instead of pondering those questions, why not just ask the men? And so he did, in a national survey and in personal interviews, what men want from their marriage, how they view the relationship, how they define a happy marriage, and so on. The result is Chethick's 2006 book, Voicemail, What Husbands Really Think About Their Marriages, Their Wives, Sex, Housework, and Commitment. Neil Chethick is a writer, speaker, and workshop leader specializing in the psychology of men. His first book, Father Loss, How Sons of All Ages Come to Terms with the Deaths of Their Dads, was published in 2001. He lives in Lexington, Kentucky, and it's from public station WUKY that he joins us today. Hello, Neil Chethick, and welcome to State of Affairs.
Thank you, Julie. It's great to be here.
The number to join our conversation this hour is 814-TALK. That's 814-8255, or toll-free 877-814-TALK, and you can also send a question or comment by email to soa@wfpl.org. Well, Neil, I'm going to start out this interview in an oh-so-typical way. The first usual question for authors, why did you write this book? Because you explain this. It's interesting to me, though, because you approach this as a journalist and a husband. And so could you tell us how it all began?
Well, it actually began about 15 years ago when I was working for a newspaper writing about other issues, and one of my editors pulled me into the office and said, what is going on with the men? And I had to find out exactly what she was talking about, but when she what she started to do was talk about what she had been reading in the paper about how men were maybe going off into the woods and banging drums and trying to if you remember those weekend retreats, and how men were gathering at churches sometimes in very large numbers and focusing on how to take back their families and things like that. So she sent me out to interview these men, and as I started to, I began to see that men were really in a very much of a flux period. They had experienced already the women's movement, and it was now more and more ingrained in the society, but men hadn't figured out where they fit in. Everything around them was changing, and how would they change? And so I ended up writing a weekly column about men's personal lives for 4 years, and each week would take on some other aspect of men's lives. That led to my book on father loss, on how men deal with the deaths of their fathers. And in that, I found many stereotypes about men and their emotional side very sort of untrue, and I began to question those stereotypes. And once that book was published, I was asked by another publisher to bring my skepticism about the stereotyping of men to the issue of marriage. And I have probably interviewed 1,000 or more men for the various books and articles that I've written, and had a wonderful time doing it.
You know, in terms of male stereotypes, and you describe this in the book very well, could you briefly sort of recap for us, you know, how did we go from a societal view of men, from a sort of a father knows best, I think is the example you used, where, you know, one that is revered, admired, respected, to today's, you know, TV dad and sitcoms and commercials, sort of the goofy, lovable buffoon, you know, what happened in these ensuing years, and how has that reinforced or changed stereotypes through the years?
Well, I think what happened was that men, you know, were on one end of the spectrum, as you were saying, father knows best, he's right, he's good, he's perfect. And as all of our flaws began to be revealed, and that happened during the 60s and 70s, we began to focus more on those. And I think, well, you know, you ask about the stereotypes, the one of them being commitment phobia, that, you know, men are aren't willing to commit to a relationship. And what I found was actually that was a stereotype. And in interviewing the men, I found that, yes, they were wary of commitment. They were they had high regard for commitment, and in that way, they tended to be slower to commit than women. But is slower to commit than women actually the same thing as commitment phobia? And what I heard from men was no. They were willing to commit, but they wanted to be very careful about it. Interestingly, while women often, I think, tended to bring more of a gut feeling, men, in deciding whether to marry or to commit, tended to be more intellectual. Their feelings would be involved, but they would think things through. I had several men who I spoke with say to me, I made a cost-benefit analysis when I was thinking about getting married. I made almost a spreadsheet where I would list the things that were positive about getting married and this person I was marrying, and then also looked at what the downside of that was. And over time, if it weighed in favor of getting married, and in other words, I think what happened was they went in with their eyes quite open, so that once they did get married, their expectations were not too great. And most men, once they marry, want to stay married. Women tend to be the ones who initiate divorce. So I think what we have is a difference in the way men and women commit, but not necessarily men being commitment phobic and women being, you know, pro-commitment.
In the men you spoke to in the personal interviews, now I want to get into in a moment how kind of your method for gathering all of this, but I know you spoke personally with some 70 men, did various interviews.
Correct.
Did they say that these societal expectations, like of how a man should behave, whether it's, you know, men don't cry or boys will be boys, is this a burden for them? Did they say they simply felt misunderstood and they didn't care, or did they feel there was a bit of a burden there and something up to which they felt they had to live?
Well, I think, yes, they felt that it is something that we are supposed to live up to. And it's one of the struggles that we have with even getting anything out of men, getting them to talk about this, because for so many years and for all the years we're growing up, we're taught pretty much not to complain, not to say I'm the victim, not to say this is a burden, just to grin and bear it. And so it isn't easy for men to share those kinds of inner struggles that they had. I did find, though, that men did say that there were times where they had to live up to certain standards that they weren't, you know, that they didn't, you know, that weren't them. Yeah. And so men much more have to prove themselves to be men than women do. A woman is a woman. A man has to show that he is a man by doing things that are manly or not feminine, you might say. So there is some of that. But, you know, there's really also, I think, a growing acceptance of men in a broader sense. That is that we're, yes, on TV and in many of the stereotyping, we still see these inept, incompetent, crazy, beer-drinking, sex-obsessed men. But what I found in going out and talking face-to-face, that you're really dealing with a mass in the middle that are typical, average people who have, you know, come home, go to work in the morning, come home at the end of the day, they spend time with their families, they watch movies, they go to Home Depot on the weekends. It's not a very complicated life, and it's but a very fulfilling life for most men.
Well, and let's talk about the people. You mentioned sort of, you know, middle of the road, average. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk more about your methods. There were two components, right? A survey and your personal interviews. Tell us how you set up the structure for gathering the information for the book.
Sure. I started and I worked with the University of Kentucky's Survey Research Center. They have a great research outreach. I helped them develop a questionnaire that we put out through telephone calls that were done by professional interviewers over the telephone nationally. And we got 300 men, or almost 300 men, to agree to about a 15 or 20 minute interview over the phone. And those were very numerical, you know, yes, no, true, false, 1 to 10, those kind of. And then out of that, we asked them, would you be willing to be interviewed further by the author of this book that's coming out? And about 80% of them said yes. So that surprised me a bit. But yeah. I then followed up and did about 70 face-to-face, mostly face-to-face interviews with men. And they went 2, 3, 4 hours. I would go to their offices, their homes. their workplaces of other kinds. And interestingly, I learned immediately that I would have to have them alone. You know, if their wives were in the room, their answers mm-hmm. were very different when she was out of the room. Or even if there were other men in the room, that was often distracting. They would worry about what that other man might think. But if I got them one-on-one, I said, I'm not going to reveal your name or anything that would identify you individually, and then started asking questions that weren't feeling-oriented questions. They weren't, how did you feel about this, or how did, you know, what was your emotion about that? But instead said, I want to hear your story. Tell me what it was like the first time you met the woman who's now your wife. What did she say? What did you do? How did you react? Those were the kind of statements that got men to talk. Those are the questions and the wording that got men to talk. They would get to their feelings. They would talk about what, you know, their emotions were, but it was through the prism of their thinking and their minds that they got to their feeling level. So I learned a lot about how to interview men through this process as well.
Yes, it is surprising when you said some 80% agreed to a follow-up, to a one-on-one interview with you, because again, mm-hmm. Sort of smashing another stereotype for a gender we consider to be mostly non-communicative, it is interesting that they would agree to that. Now, once you got the ball rolling, you said you learned how to help them open themselves up, you know,
exactly.
to all of this. Did you have a sense they were eager to have their point of view told, to have their story told? Do they understand that they haven't been heard as much maybe as they should have?
I think that's part of it, but I think like anyone else, they wanted to tell their story. You know, we think of our lives, and I think men may be in particular this way, we think of our lives as kind of a story with a beginning, and we're in the middle somewhere, mm-hmm. and, you know, there'll be an end sometimes. So to be able to stop and think about it and go to the beginning and follow it through and have somebody on the other side of a table or the other side of a tape recorder who's just eager to hear it, that, I think, is what turned these men into talkers. As well, I wasn't saying to them, how do you feel? So I wasn't mm-hmm. bringing the feeling level to the first. I wasn't saying that, I don't care what your story is, I just want to know how you felt about it. So then it was easy for them to go into that. They were easy for them to talk about what they did or how they reacted or what they said. And then it became just a kind of, you know, a plot with a story and suspense and mystery. And then I found no trouble at all getting them to talk.
You know, and several of them, I mean, spoke with great candor. When you talked mm-hmm. about when they admitted to striking their wives upon occasion.
Yes. Yep. About 15 to 20% of the men said that sometime in their current marriage, there had been violence. Now, interestingly, they described it as, in most cases, as mutual violence. Mm-hmm. That is, one hit and the other hit, or even that their wives were the one who hit them. And they, you know, were open to that. They talked about affairs that they had. They talked about, you know, the struggle to not have affairs. You know, when you're in a marriage, it doesn't mean that you don't still, you're not still connected to the world. You're not still looking at other people. You're not still feeling sexual attraction. How do you deal with that? How do you make sex exciting within a marriage that's lasted 20 or 30 or 40? And as I think I mentioned in the book, one man I spoke with had been married for 72 years. So how do you make that relationship work over time? What's the arc of that relationship? And it was really interesting for someone just married 20 years to hear these people who are married for 50 and 60 and longer.
That's very interesting. We have a lot of ground to cover. When we get back, we're going to talk more in detail about some gender stereotypes and about Neil's work in sort of turning over those stereotypes. But we want to hear from you, too, this hour during our conversation about marriage from the male point of view. What is your view as a husband? Do you see yourself in some of the things we've been talking about? And for both husbands and wives, what have you learned from each other or about yourself about making a marriage work? 814-TALK, 814-8255, or toll-free 877-814-TALK. Or send an email to SOA at WFPL.org. You're listening to State of Affairs on WFPL.
Mm-hmm. For more information about this topic, as well as information about publications mentioned on State of Affairs, or to email us regarding any recent shows, just click on State of Affairs when you visit our website, wfpl.org.
Welcome back to State of Affairs. I'm Julie Credens. We're talking this hour with Neil Chethick. He's a journalist and author of Voicemail, What Husbands Really Think About Their Marriages, Their Wives, Sex, Housework, and Commitment. And it's your opportunity to join us with questions or comments. We'd love to hear from husbands and wives this hour. Some comments, questions about what you're hearing from this book, 814-TALK, 814-8255, toll-free 877-814-TALK. And Neil, I want to get back to that you were talking about the stereotype that men are commitment phobic, and you were explaining a little bit about it's not so much commitment phobic, but men sort of approach the decision to marry perhaps in a different way. How do men fall in love? What did they say about meeting their wives? Is it sometimes love at first sight? What's going on here? Give us some insight.
Yes, sure. It is sometimes love at first sight, but like with all love at first sight, it declines or changes over time. Interestingly, I mean, and I think when I asked men specifically, what was it that attracted you to your wife or the woman who then later became your wife? And many of them said, of course, that there was a physical connection, attraction. They saw her somewhere. There was something about her. But it wasn't always in the classic sense of beauty that you might see the way they portray it in the media these days. There sometimes was just a way that she walked, or the way her eyes, you know, connected with his, or something about her smile. So it was the personality coming through as well. The other thing that when I asked, once you moved beyond the first blush, quite literally, what was it that made this person someone you would consider staying with, someone who not only you were attracted to, but that you might want to marry? And there was a couple of things that stood out. One of them, this I had never really heard before, but it made sense to me. There was a sense that men wanted a positive, optimistic person. Men grow up in their homes, most of our homes, where our mother set the emotional climate. And so to have somebody who was positive, who was upbeat, who was adventurous, who had a certain sense of optimism about the world, that was very attractive to men, because they could kind of step into that, and they would know that on a day-to-day basis that's what their world would probably be like. Didn't mean that, you know, it would be like that 100% of the time, but that just that if she inclined toward that, if she was very exciting and excited about the world, men tended to be attracted to that. The other thing was the sense of self-confidence, that men like women who think they're special, because then it makes the men think that they're special as well. And so, you know, women who saw that, well, maybe they weren't the classic beauty, but they really knew how to do a conversation. They knew they were funny. They were interesting and interested in learning new things. These were the kinds of things that men told me attracted them and made them want to continue to know this person and then eventually stay with them.
It was interesting when you know, there were quotes from men, as you're saying, when written about descriptions they use when they talk about meeting their wives for the first time. And yes, you know, there is some element of physical attraction, whether it's in sort of a classic sense or in the eye of the beholder, so to speak. But it was so much more so, they would say, about her energy, her joy, or she was the life of the party. You know, which I think dispels a lot of what women usually think, and that is that many women are convinced, oh, well, if I'm not, you know, a supermodel, he won't think twice about me. Or, you know, but that's, again, I think what society is doing to women's minds as well.
Well, most men expect or not from men. Yeah, and I think what happens is most men know that they're not supermodels. So it's, you know, one thing that I saw was that most men and women kind of find themselves in a, you know, wherever they stand in the, you know, in the classic 1 through 10 they sort of find their equal, their match, and that attracts them, and they see that there's possibilities there, and so they explore those together. And I think, you know, we all know that we have most of us know that we have to have something more than that surface level of attraction. Many of the men, in fact, I talked with who were now married a second or a third time, said the biggest mistake they made was marrying someone based almost entirely on the fact that she was beautiful. They thought, well, she's beautiful, I'll be able to change the other parts of her. Mm-hmm. I'll be able to change whatever it is, or she'll grow, or I'll accept it, or it won't really matter. But really, once you get months or years into a relationship, what really matters to men is to be in a good friendship with that person. Almost all of the men who had been married more than 10 years said that it was the friendship that they had, the trust that they had. In fact, several use the phrase, "She's got my back," which is a phrase that men will use with each other sometimes. You know, we know he's a great friend if he's got my back. Mm-hmm. And they would say that about the women in their lives, that no matter what would happen, she would protect him. And probably not in a physical way necessarily, but in an emotional way or from other, you know, dangers outside of the relationship.
You're listening to State of Affairs. We're talking this hour with Neil Chethick. He's a journalist. He's the author of Voicemail, What Husbands Really Think About Their Marriages, Their Wives, Sex, Housework, and Commitment. And we want to go to the phones now, hear what our callers have to say. And we do encourage you husbands, are you hearing yourselves in what we're talking about? Wives, we want you to chime in as well. What makes your marriage work? How did you figure things out along the way? 814-TALK, 814-8255. And John, you are first on the program. Welcome.
Hello, hello. I just have a couple comments. First of all, I am a supermodel, but I've been insanely married for 10 years now, and I've been through, you know, as with any commitment, I guess you go through all these crazy stages, and at one of the crazier stages, I asked a friend of mine who had been married over 40 years what kind of advice she could give me, and she said, you got to kind of think of it as what are your relationships been with your best friend? And I said, well, sometimes, you know, I don't really care if I see my best friend. Sometimes I get into gigantic arguments with my best friend. And she kind of, I guess, took some of the romantic side of it off and kind of polished it up to really what it really was that, you know, some people take a marriage and give it all of this wild glam that it should have sometimes, but a lot of times it's really nothing but just another relationship that you have with a person. Mm-hmm. But I guess the romantic side of it gets a little overblown sometimes. And I guess that's the end of the comment.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think John has a great point, and I heard that again and again, is that if you inflate the expectations so high, then it's, of course, the reality is going to fall short of that. But if you are realistic about it, then you can really get somewhere. And, you know, it's not so much about loving, because even people who split up are often still love each other. The problem, and John was saying, was living together. How do you each day make mesh? How do you get up in the morning, enjoy sharing the same space with another person, and working out all the specific little details, like who does what housework-wise, and who's taking care of the kid and picking the kid up? All that has to be able to be worked together. Men often talked about teamwork, about being a partnership, not just a lover.
You use a phrase, too, and John, thank you for your call. A great comment there. You talked, too, about women want sort of face-to-face, and men approach a relationship more side-to-side. Can you explain that?
Yeah, several of men described this to me. I think if we remember childhood, you look at men tended not to be, or boys tended not to play face-to-face. While girls might sit together and be across from each other and look into each other's faces, men tended to be side-by-side. Think of a basketball court. You've got five men all going in one direction. They're not talking to each other. They're being physical. So we might not know what the deep, dark secrets of that man is over to the right or to the left, but we do know that he's going to be 5 steps ahead right when you pass that ball. So there's communication going on. And sometimes we look at men and we say, you know, they're not communicating. He's not communicating. When really we mean he's not talking. It doesn't mean he's not communicating. He may well be communicating. And one of the things he may be communicating is that I like to be in the same space with you, but I don't necessarily want to be face to face with you.
And see, and there's the disconnect, you know, or
yes,
oftentimes the disconnect, because the women want the face to face. And can you give a great example in your book of a couple there, I think, hanging wallpaper, getting rid of hanging wallpaper.
Exactly.
Jake Morrison, I think, is the name that comes to mind. And it was this couple, again, because of sort of a side-by-side, a team thing going on. And you said he described this encounter or this time with his wife as intimate. And a woman
yes.
might think, what do you mean?
They were basically redoing a room together and putting up wallpaper and taking off the wallpaper, and the walls started to fall off with the wallpaper.
Yes.
And they both looked at this crashing of plaster on the floor and, you know, in disbelief for a moment, and then they broke into laughter. And he remembered this years later as just a real moment of connection between the two of them. He likes to do things with his wife and accomplish things with his wife and create something like that room that they can both enjoy. She, on the other hand, and I think he even said this, likes to curl up on the sofa and watch a movie together or have intimate conversations.
Yeah.
What he had to learn, and I think he said she learned it as well, is that both can happen. It's, you know, we don't have to do either her way or his way. But if we know that he's communicating love by doing that room together, then a woman can know that this doesn't mean that he doesn't love me because he doesn't want to talk with me or cuddle with me or do other things that I love. Or, you know, so we have to learn how to give to each other, but we also have to learn how to accept that the other person might express themselves in a different way.
Let's take another caller now, and we're talking this hour about marriage from the male viewpoint. We'd love to hear yours. 814-TALK, 814-8255. And Craig, you are next. Go ahead, please.
Yes. I've been married for 7 years. I think I have a good marriage, but I think we've lost kind of the adventure aspect of our marriage. We're best friends, but we've kind of lost the ability to have adventure. I'm not a very spontaneous person. And I wanted to know, get a little advice about that, and I'll take my call off the air.
Okay. Well, Neil, you're a marriage counselor at this point, too. No, but based, I know you don't come to this program as a psychologist, but based on what you've heard from men that you've talked to, what might you say to Craig about this kind of
problem? Well, the first thing I'd say is that he is among millions of men who have been in that situation. And it's ironic, I guess, that he says it's been 7 years, because that's not atypical for at that point. I think there's especially a struggle, and Craig didn't say whether or not he has children, but that can be a particular problem. If you have children, how do you maintain the relationship? How do you maintain the focus on each other? Whether, you know, when you have this other being or other beings to focus on. So the men that I spoke with, and they gave a lot of attention to this, and I asked these men for advice from a very selfish perspective, and they said that really you have to plan romance. Sometimes we say, well, let's wait for a spontaneous moment, but sometimes you can say, well, why don't we plan an evening out, plan to go somewhere, get out of the home or the same spaces that we're in, go away for a weekend, and then really pay attention to what, you know, talk to each other, something men find sometimes difficult to do, but talk to each other about what really turns them on, what makes life fun and adventurous to them, and try to recapture what it was that happened in the early phase of the relationship. It's also good to know that there are ebbs and flows in every relationship, and that men I spoke with who had the perspective of 20 and 30 and 40 years were able to say, you know, there were a couple years back then that we really weren't on the same wavelength, but then it came back. We worked at it, or it just came around over time. So I think, you know, and that gave me hope too, because I know there are times in my relationship where we just feel like the disconnect or mm-hmm. that we're on our own parallel tracks. And we pay attention to that and try to find the way back to each other, but also know that there's cycles in both of our lives. We are individuals still, even when we're coupled.
Craig, thanks for joining us. 814-TALK, 814-8255. I think we have time for another call before our second break, and that's John in Eminence, Kentucky. Hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I am curious as to, I haven't read your book. I'm just wondering if you dealt with the male's spouse's relationship with her father and how that was a deciding factor in whether or not to get married or even pursue a relationship.
Well, that's a fascinating question. I actually did not directly ask the questions about the woman's father. What I did was to find out about the man and his father, the husband. There's a sort of old conventional wisdom that if you want to know how a man will treat his wife, look at his relationship with his mother, mm-hmm. and that you would learn something there. I tested that statistically and found that there was no relationship. That is, if a man has a good relationship with his mother, he's no more or less likely to have a good relationship with his wife. However, his relationship with his father made a huge difference. So women who are looking at men, knowing that that man has a good relationship with a father, will probably find someone who will be more likely to be able to connect because he's seen it. He's watched this man connect with his own wife. He's watched him connect, with the son himself. So the son and the father have a good relationship, the son and his wife will. Anecdotally, I did see that women who had good relationships with their fathers also tended to have good relationships with their husbands. But I don't have statistics to back that one up.
When you talk about, you know, looking at men's relationship with their father, is it the relationship or is it the kind of modeling that the father provided? I mean, did some of the men you spoke to say, well, you know, my father was a womanizer or this, and so I determined that I would not be that way? Or did you find that men sometimes will fall into the model that their father set for them?
Yes, it's very difficult to shake the model, even if you know that it's wrong, because you're pushing against something rather than having something that you can cling on to. In other words, if a father is a womanizer, then you know you don't want to be, but you don't necessarily know what you do want to be. So how can you learn that if you haven't had a man like that in your home? And what I found was that some men are able to overcome it, but it's like learning as an adult and reaching out to other men who are in good relationships and finding out what they're doing rather than trying to wing it yourself without a model. The men who learned directly from their fathers, watched him and experienced him, then have that inside of them. You know, the son then carries that within them and they don't have to work as hard to be able to be in relationship with others.
Very interesting. Anil, it's time for our second break, so when we come back, we'll continue the conversation on men and marriage. And we'd like to hear from more of you. Husbands, how do you express your feelings about your marriage? What do you wish your wife knew about how you were feeling or how you viewed your own marriage? 814-TALK, 814-8255, or toll-free 877-814-TALK. You're listening to State of Affairs on WFPL.
State of Affairs is made possible by the University of Louisville, committed to excellence in undergraduate and graduate education. The University of Louisville, Kentucky's Metropolitan Research University, and by the members of Louisville's Public Radio Partnership.
Welcome back to State of Affairs. I'm Julie Credens. Our conversation continues now with Neil Chethick, a journalist and author of Voicemail, What Husbands Really Think About Their Marriages, Their Wives, Sex, Housework, and Commitment. It's your turn to join us with your questions or comments, 814-TALK, 814-8255. Let's go right back to the phones and welcome Steve to the conversation. Steve, what's on your mind this hour?
Yes, I'm really enjoying the program this morning. I really appreciate it. I find that I find myself in what your guest has wrote. I mean, I think he's right on the money. Now, I'm personally not married, and I'm 47 years old, and I began to think something was wrong with me when he talked about how men look at it like a spreadsheet and not go so much with how they feel, but over time, the pros outweigh the cons. I find that that's myself, and I just really enjoyed the program, and I thought that he understands how I feel. It was like a light came on, so that's why I called, because I love women, and I hope to be married someday, but I do look at it like a spreadsheet, and I'm more of a worker, and let's get this done, let's get that done, and let's, you know, accent and make positive what we need to make positive and do what we need to do and to make the relationship go forward. And I just felt that hearing him say that, like I said, it was me. So right. That's why I called in, because I can see where I've done exactly what he said so many of these men that he's interviewed have done.
Mm-hmm.
Looked at a relationship in the terms of, or the relationship in terms of the good outweighing the bad. And for a long time, I thought that, well, maybe I'm doing something wrong or I'm dysfunctional, but the women would be emotional and more mushy-mushy, quote-unquote, and I'm more, okay, we need to get this done and this needs to be done, and more, you know,
Trying
to take care of business.
Yeah. So,
and so I'm in much agreement with that. And then the last part of what you talked about as far as with fathers, you know, I have a very dysfunctional relationship with my father, but I don't think my father was abusive to my mother or a womanizer, but I don't know. I'm weighing now and thinking how that plays a part in me looking at females,
mm-hmm.
which I know, like I said, your guest didn't go into great detail with as far as the book is concerned.
Right.
But
hey, Steve, I want to use your situation as a bit of an example, if I could, and that is, you mentioned, you know, you're 47, not married yet, and Steve, great comments, thank you. But Neil, using Steve as an example, did mm-hmm. you talk with many men who were much later in life before they got married, and how did that change the way they approached their marriage?
Yeah, I talked with some, and interesting from a purely statistical viewpoint, men who were married between the ages of 25 and 35 had the most likely the highest chances of success in the marriage in terms of staying married. Mm-hmm. That people who married men who married under the age of 25 tended to be more likely to get divorced, and then if they waited till they were after 35, they would also, in some ways, we get set in our ways, and so the likelihood was going up. I really appreciated what Steve said, because that's the response I've gotten from people who have read the book, in terms of it being affirming of their real experience, that, you know, they think there's something, and this is something about men, when it comes to the emotional side of life, we tend to think that we're doing something wrong. This happened in regards to my first book, Father Loss, on how men deal with the deaths of their fathers. If we don't cry over the death, then is there something wrong with us? And what I found with that and with how we deal with relationships, that it's not that there's something wrong, it's that we do it differently. And so far, we as men have not spoken openly or found the words mm-hmm. to really get that across. So I just, as a writer, of course, you just really appreciate hearing someone who gets what you're trying to do.
Sure. And Steve, thanks for joining us. And next up, we speak with Melvin from here in Louisville. Hello, Melvin.
Hey, Neil, this is Melvin, and I'm one of the men that he interviewed.
Ah, okay. Hi, Melvin.
And I don't necessarily have a particular question, just kind of calling in and see if you had something for me.
well, and this is interesting, because Neil, have you heard from these men? Now, we're hearing from Melvin now. Have you heard back from them? Any kind of follow up or things that have happened since you talked with them?
I've kept in touch usually by email because they're around the country, you know, with or you know, certainly sent them copies of the book and thanked them for their contribution. And mm-hmm. you know, and I think what was interesting about people like Melvin and others is that their willingness to talk had to do with wanting to help other men and mm-hmm. women too in relationships, and wanting to break this sort of code of silence that we have about the personal side of our lives. But it's very difficult to do that in the culture that we're in, because every time a man speaks the kinds of truths that are underneath the surface there, we tend to be looked at funny. Mm-hmm. There's mm-hmm. what's wrong with that guy? He's not acting the way a man is supposed to act.
Exactly.
So I just wanted to, you know, Melvin was one of the many who, you know, opened themselves up, made themselves vulnerable, told their truths, and I think it's helping others.
Melvin, thanks for touching base with Neil and for sharing your story with him in the first place. We appreciate
All right.
that. Thanks for calling.
Bye, Melvin.
And next we speak with Maurice. Hello, welcome to State of Affairs.
How you guys doing?
Fine, thanks.
Hi,
Good.
Maurice.
Just listening and just thinking about my own situation here. I am married, have been for almost 17 years. Me and my wife have actually gone through the steps of divorce up to the last point of actually signing the paperwork. We decided to reconcile, and but in this reconciliation period, I still don't think my wife is getting me emotionally. In the time that we were apart, I was involved with another woman, and it just astonished me how within the short period of time that I was involved with this woman that she got me. I try to look at it and think, well, maybe she's just doing this to maybe cater to the thing that I've expressed to her about mm-hmm. my feelings and so on and so forth, to being good with me. But we broke off the relationship, but we still communicate on what we want to say, friend level, with, you know, mm-hmm. nothing physically involved there.
Mm-hmm.
Even with that, she still, I mean, without spoken word or, you know, she gets me emotionally. And it really concerns me because I don't know if it's because of what me and my wife went through with the whole process of divorce or whatever, but, you know, I love my wife, but I'm not really in love with my wife.
Mm. Oh, that's an interesting comment. Did you hear that at all, Neil?
Yes, it has,
you know, sort of transitioned into something else.
Yeah, and I think a lot of this, I was talking a little earlier about how early we get married, and sometimes I think we make choices, you know, if we're marrying and when we're 19, and I don't know this is true, of course, with Maurice, but if you're marrying when you're 19 or 20, you make decisions that may not be about the long term, may not, and you may not know yourself well enough. She may not know herself well enough to be able to connect emotionally. And so, you know, I sympathize with his struggle, because I think there are a lot of men who want their marriages to work, who are willing to give it extra time to make sacrifices that are big in their own lives to, you know, make the marriage work.
Mm-hmm.
But despite that, they aren't able to get to that level of connection. You know, it right. can happen, but you know, marriage is the happily ever after myth is probably the greatest one. You know, most movies end right after the kiss and the altar,
yeah.
when really life is just starting at that point.
Very good. Maurice, thanks again for calling. And our last call of the hour comes from Ed in Elizabethtown. Hello, Ed.
How are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Hi, Ed.
I've been married for 26 years, and I'm 45 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And my father or my parents divorced when I was 5. So I think I'm a little bit of an anomaly
mm-hmm.
Conversation. But I wanted to say that I've always been in love with my wife.
Mm-hmm.
We've had our ups and downs, but we worked through them. And sometimes it was difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I said I'm always in love. You're not always, you know, goo-goo in love, but you have a connection.
Mm-hmm.
Raised two kids. They're out of the house now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the most beautiful part of my life is being married to my wife. Mm. I truly believe it is, happily ever after in my life. Because I can't imagine living without her in my life.
Well, Ed, thank you for sharing that with us this hour. Neil, is that a common theme? I mean, maybe in more marriages than one would realize.
You know, there obviously he got married young, and has, you can tell in his voice, he's just worked really hard, and he's gotten to this place. And that's actually a good place for us to begin to wrap up, in the sense that many of the men I spoke with who had been married for the longer period, the 30 and 40 and 50 year, had a very sort of condescending idea when I brought up the word soulmate. Mm-hmm. That on the one hand, a soulmate is a good goal for a marriage, but finding a soulmate, as if you would bump into one, isn't really, what happens. You find someone who you can connect with, and then by going through hard times, by raising children together, by working and getting laid off and supporting each other and doing whatever it takes, working out all your problems, you become a soulmate to another person. Soulmates are created. And so these men who have been married 40, 50 years, and obviously Ed, in his 25 or more years, he has found a soulmate, but he probably didn't have one when they were 19 years old.
You know, we have just a couple minutes left. There's way too much in your book to try to cover in an hour, but I want to touch ever so briefly on the fact that the word housework appears in your book title. It's sort of intriguing. It's right up there with wives, marriage, and commitment. Quickly, the relationship between house cleaning and marital happiness. Can you brief us on this?
I should write a second book on this whole point, because it does actually show up everywhere. The happier the wife, and this is from the man's point of view, the happier a man's wife is with the division of housework, the happier he is in the sex department, the happier the marriage is overall, the less likely there will be divorce. And if you pull out almost any other attribute in a marriage, the woman's happiness in housework is what it's about. And I think it doesn't have to be him doing it, or doing even 50% of it. It has to be him engaged in it. That is, he either is doing it, he's aware that she's doing it and is appreciative of that and does other things to balance that, or he's willing to hire somebody to help with housework. You know, women still feel, 40 years after the women's movement, still feel the greater burden about what the house looks like and feels like. And if a man can see that and affirm that and in some way help in that sense, and I don't mean help as in an outsider, but be equal in it, then it tends to make the whole marriage stronger and have a feeling of fairness and satisfaction from her point of view.
Well, it's something to consider. Instead of bringing home candy and flowers, stop at the store and get some end dust, mops, brooms, this kind of thing. You never know. And very quickly, just to let's leave on an up note here also, of the statistic on men who, if given the opportunity, would marry the same woman again.
This was probably the most surprising statistic.
I throw this at you with like 15 seconds. So
the most surprising statistic was, I asked the question, would you marry the same woman if you had the opportunity? 93% of men said yes, they would. Men love their wives, and they want to stay in the relationship, even if there are problems.
All right. Well, encouraging words from Neil Chethick. He is a journalist and author of Voicemail, What Husbands Really Think About Their Marriages, Their Wives, Sex, Housework, and Commitment, published this year by Simon & Schuster. He joined us from public station WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky. And Neil, thanks so much for your time this hour.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Julie.
I want to thank our callers for sharing their stories and thoughts as well. We do appreciate your input. For more information about today's program, go to WFPL.org and select State of Affairs from the program list. You can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. State of Affairs is produced by the Public Radio Partnership with support from the University of Louisville. Robin Fisher is our producer. Our assistant is Laura Ellis. Our in- Snow. State of Affairs website is maintained by Alice Thompson. I'm Julie Credens. I hope you'll join us next time for another edition of State of Affairs.
The views presented on State of Affairs do not necessarily reflect those of the University of Louisville, Public Radio Partnership, or its underwriters.